Well, today we have been, we're going through the book of Daniel, and we've come to Daniel chapter 8, the 8th chapter of Daniel. And in order to understand Daniel chapter 8, it's a unique passage of prophecy in Daniel in a way, because it's all focused on events that actually happened historically. There are events that are behind us today, but were ahead of Daniel at the time when he was writing around, 600 BC. So there are a couple of main characters in this chapter that I want to just give you a cursory sort of historical survey of two particular characters who are referenced here. Just to refresh your memory, I'm sure you know all this stuff. I'm sure your schools did a great job of teaching you Grecian history, but just in case you were sick that day and didn't hear it, we're going to see two interesting characters. One of them, Alexander the Great, and the second one, Antiochus the Fourth, or he called himself Antiochus Epiphanes. Both of these guys are central in the prophecies of Daniel chapter 8. So Alexander the Great, he truly was great. He was an amazing guy. He came to power, just to give you a historical position, about 336 BC. His father, Philip II, was the king of Greece, and he was assassinated. And so his son, Alexander, took the throne at the age of 20. Alexander was just because he's his son, put him in. Alexander was an amazing military leader. Even before this, he started commanding armies when he was 16. Now, he was a brilliant guy. He studied personally under Aristotle, one of the wisest and most intelligent people in the history of civilization, for sure. Studied under Aristotle and then became a military leader. In his entire life, he died at 32, sadly, but in his entire life, he never lost a single battle. His understanding of military strategy, and you can imagine, when you have courage and ability to communicate with people, but at the same time, you have this brain that had been nurtured by the great Aristotle, who was the protege of Plato. I mean, Western civilization, Greek civilization, classical civilization, he had it all. And so he was brilliant. And he went out from originally in Greece, if you think of the Grecian peninsula, and he swept across Turkey, Asia Minor, as it's called historically usually, over into Asia, the areas of Syria and Iran and Iraq and down through Israel and to northern Africa and Egypt. And Alexander the Great conquered on a march all the way to India, just short of China, really, during this time. So he built this amazing kingdom. And again, never losing a single battle. He was charismatic. He was inspiring, and he was brilliant. To this day, military strategists study the strategies of Alexander the Great. He was that good at what he did. Now, he had achieved all of this by the age of 30. Now, there's a myth, an urban myth that it's been repeated for the last 300 years, and pastors repeat it all the time, that Alexander, at the end of conquering all of these kingdoms, sat on a rock and cried because there were no more kingdoms to conquer. He never did that. At least there was no record of it for the first 2,000 years of from Alexander's time. He did cry, though, just the opposite of that. He had a cry one time, and he drank a lot, so maybe that made him emotional, but he cried that there wasn't enough time in the world, in a lifetime, to conquer all of the kingdoms that should be conquered. He had this, he was driven and greatly ambitious. In the end, he he left a will. He died at 32, and he left a will telling his descendants, telling those who would come after him, here's the plan. And part of his plan was to circumnavigate the continent of Africa. He wanted to rebuild Babylon, to its original glory. I mean, he wanted to head up north toward the Scandinavian countries. He was incredibly ambitious. In the early days, people loved him. He was very popular, nice guy, very selfless. Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. So by the end of his short life, he had become quite a jerk. He was very mean, and people talked about just how it had completely gone to his head. Ultimately, he died in Babylon, probably from alcohol poisoning. He was drinking all the time. He was somebody that they said really wasn't interested in women. He had a large harem, but they said that he never did anything with them, but he loved to drink. And he was possibly poisoned. Somebody may have poisoned his alcohol, but he was either alcohol poisoning or some other poison through alcohol, and he ended up dying in Babylon, which he had intended on rebuilding. When Alexander the Great died, you'd think, wow, the Greek Empire is over, because there's no one who had the capacities to do everything that he was able to do. And that was true. So he had four primary generals who ended up dividing the kingdom among them. These four guys, they had been buddies of his. In fact, three of them studied with him under Aristotle when they were young teenagers. But these generals divided the kingdom by quadrants. Cassander took the Greek and Macedonian, the Greek peninsula. Lysimachus took what we call Turkey or Asia Minor. Ptolemy took the southern part, Egypt, and including what, historically is called Palestine, but Israel and the surrounding territories of Israel. And then Seleucus, his fourth general, took the land of Persia, up there north of Israel, and then the property in Asia that they had, and all the way to India. And so his kingdom ended up being divided in four quadrants like that. Which brings us to the second person who's referenced in Daniel 8, and that is Antiochus IV, or Antiochus Epiphanes. He came to power in 175 BC, and he was a Seleucid general. So you remember, the Seleucids are the ones who had Asia, the northern part, like in Iraq and places like that, all the way across to India. So he was the king of the Seleucids, but he was greatly ambitious. Plus, he was a guy, and he was very talented as well, but he loved the Holy Land. He loved the area of Israel. But of course, that had been divided to the Ptolemies along with Egypt. So what Antiochus did was he went down south and conquered the Ptolemies in Egypt, then moved his way north, captured Israel as a part of his reign, which also included Asia, of course, and even to the area of Cyprus and ultimately much of the Grecian peninsula. So he was on his own reclaiming much of what had been Alexander's kingdom. Not all of it, but quite a bit of it. He was really hesitant in the western part, because by this time, Rome was beginning to build. Before Rome would come in and establish the Roman Empire, he was nervous about Rome, so he was nice to them, so he was focusing his attention in the land of Israel, primarily. And so he had this great ambition, great, skills, and a little nervousness about Rome, but he began to persecute the Jews because he loved that area of southern Israel, Judea. He was so fascinated by that, by the ancient culture, the temple that had been rebuilt there, the history of David and Solomon. And so for him, he wasn't comfortable necessarily saying, I'm going to rebuild Babylon. He thought, man, I'm going to do it right down here. This is the heart of where my power is. And so in the process of that, a lot of Jews in Israel became what we call, and you'll see them referenced in the New Testament, as the Hellenists. A lot of Jews just decided, hey, this works for us. Let's just be, we'll be Jews, but we're really Greeks. We're taking on the Greek culture. But there was a real division, even as today there is in Israel, between those who are really Orthodox Jews and those who are Jews, but yeah, they're really more a part of the rest of the culture. They're more Reformed. So he ended up, these really Jewish Jews were such a threat to Antiochus, threat to his power, that he began to take over. Well, he came in and he defiled the temple, for instance, that had been built during the time of, rebuilt during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. And so he defiled it, sacrificed within the Holy of Holies, sacrificed a pig, declared himself to be the Messiah, and basically drove the religious Jews out of the temple and out of that area of Israel. Well, he put a Greek guy as the high priest there at the temple. There was a small town priest named Matthias who came along and killed that guy. And so, oh boy, here we go. And Matthias had four sons. They're called the Maccabees. That was their last name. Judas Maccabeus was the oldest son, and he led their terrorist activity as they begin to attack Greek soldiers. At first, they began to attack the Hellenistic Jews, but they cleaned house. And if you are a Catholic, or if you've ever read the apocryphal books that are included in the Catholic Bible, the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees tell the story of these battles and how Judas Maccabeus and his brothers came in and really soundly defeated these Greeks in Israel. And that was the beginning of the end for Antiochus Epiphanes, because Antiochus, you know, he had this big kingdom he was trying to oversee. Israel was his favorite, and now the people that he put in charge of that had been killed, and the Jews who were Hellenistic, who were supporting him, were getting wiped out as well. He ended up being driven out of Israel, and in 2 Maccabees, it says that God struck him and that his guts just exploded. You know, it's hard to establish that. The other story of how he died was that he got in a boat and then was so distraught at losing this amazing kingdom that he had built that he committed suicide by jumping overboard. So at any rate, he died a kind of a sad death, and it created a really inspiring time of history for the Jews, which the story of the Maccabees is what led to the holiday that the Jews now call Hanukkah, or the Festival of Lights, which was celebrating when they reconsecrated the temple. Now, one way that the Maccabees were able to drive out Antiochus, they allied with the Romans, because the Roman Empire was beginning to build in Italy. Now, the Grecian Empire was starting to cave in on itself. So this helps us to understand this transition, that as the Maccabees partnered with the Romans, which made Antiochus so penned in, then that's why in the time of Christ, you know, 100 and some years later, the Romans have this presence in Israel, and yet they have a partnership with the religious Jews, the Pharisees and scribes and Pharisees and people like that. It all goes back to this time of the Maccabees, when this partnership between the Orthodox Jews and the Romans crushed the Grecian Empire. And so anyway, Antiochus Epiphanes, which his name was Antiochus IV, he named himself Epiphanes. An epiphany is when someone has a sudden revelation from God. So he had quite an ego as well. So that leads us up to Daniel chapter 8, which is going to describe these historical events. This vision, it says, Daniel had this in the third year of Belshazzar. So he's going back to a time, you know, in chapter 7, he had that vision in the first year of Belshazzar. That was after Nebuchadnezzar had died. Belshazzar and probably his dad Nabonidus were in charge, but Belshazzar was the one who was there in the area of Babylon. So Daniel has this vision. Daniel's probably semi-retired, we think, because when you go back to the story of the handwriting on the wall when Belshazzar ended up being killed, it seemed like they called Daniel out of retirement to come and interpret the handwriting on the wall. So this is the time period of this. But he says that he stood there and he saw a vision. And next to the river, there was a ram in verse 3 that had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. Later in the chapter, the angel explains to him that this was the Medo-Persian Empire. Remember the sequence. We saw this in Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2 and in Daniel's vision in chapter 7, that following the Babylonian kingdom, there would be a Medo-Persian kingdom followed by a Greek and then a Roman kingdom. So this ram has two horns, one bigger than the other, and it's pushing west, north, and south. It didn't really, the Medo-Persian Empire never tried to go east of Babylon at all. And nobody could withstand them. They had a great thing going. But as he was looking at it, here comes a male goat coming from the west, coming from Greece, basically, across the surface of the whole earth. And he came to the ram with the two horns and ran at it with power, confronted the ram. He was moved with rage against him, like this fierce attack from Alexander the Great against the Medes and Persians, attacked them, broke the two horns, and they couldn't defend themselves. He trampled them. And therefore, in verse 8, the male goat grew very great. Ironic. Alexander the Great, he grew great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken. Right at the peak of his power and popularity, he was broken. And in place of it, four notable ones, important people, came up toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them, the Seleucids, came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward Egypt, toward the east, still in Asia, and toward the glorious land, focusing on Israel. Obvious reference to Antiochus IV. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars. It's not clear what that means, and the angel never interprets that, but it implies that there were some spiritual battles going on with Antiochus, which would totally explain a lot of things about his abilities. He exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. He was like, he made himself God. Daily sacrifices were taken away because he defiled the temple and took it out of use, and the place of his sanctuary ultimately was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. Now in verse 13, it says that, you know, I heard Daniel speaking. I heard a holy one, probably an angel, speaking. And another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? So how long is this time of this little horn, Antiochus, going to last? And he said to me, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Now, 2,300 days, you know, a little less than 7 years, 6.5 years or something, was about the time when Antiochus was ultimately dominating the area of Israel. So it's probably just to be taken literally. There are various crackpots that have tried to turn these into years and predict the coming of Christ and stuff, but you can't read it from here. Remember, here's an important distinction between the vision in chapter 2 that Nebuchadnezzar had, where there were four kingdoms, and the fourth one that went on until Messiah returned and the stone came from heaven and smashed the beast. Then in the explanation later in chapter 7, where you have this, the Roman Empire as the final kingdom, when then Messiah comes and sets up his reign, there's a difference here, because here there's only the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, Alexander the Great, ultimately the Greek Empire bringing out Antiochus Epiphanes, who was also, you know, a Greek king, and that sort of ends it. So the little horn in chapter 7 that happens in the end times that'll be destroyed by Jesus isn't the same little horn. They're analogous. But here we don't see this ending with this brilliant, victorious coming of Christ. Therefore, this is a different time. But you could say that Antiochus Epiphanes is maybe a type of Christ. But so then in verse 15, Daniel says, I saw the vision and I was trying to figure out what it meant. And there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. So he wasn't a man, but he looked like a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he said, Gabriel was sent to me to explain this whole thing, for which we're truly grateful. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. Now, the time of the end doesn't mean, some people have misunderstood this to mean, oh, that's in the final days. But that phrase, the time of the end, the Hebrew word kates that's used here, just means when it's time. This is going to happen when it's time for it to happen. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and stood me upright. And he said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time. And again, it's the word kates, which means when it's time. This time of indignation, that word, that Hebrew word is a word that means wrath, or literally frothing, when God's frothing at the mouth. This is what's going to happen at the appointed time. The end shall be. The ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. Now, it would be pretty easy for Daniel to have a concept that the Medo-Persian Empire was the great threat at that time to what was left of the Babylonian Empire. So this isn't shocking, but I'm still thankful that Gabriel explained it to us so that we get the flow of, okay, so that first ram, that's with the two horns, that's Medes and Persians, their empire. But this is kind of shocking in verse 21. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece, which was basically unheard of for them. Greece wasn't a major power at the time of Daniel. So he says, that's the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that's between its eyes is the first real king of the Grecian Empire, which we know now, it was hundreds of years after Daniel, was clearly Alexander the Great. As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. That's pretty stunning. There's going to be a Grecian empire with a great king, and when he dies, there are going to be four people that take it, but they really, because they divide up, they don't have the same power that he has. And, verse 23, in the latter time of their kingdom, towards the end of the Greek Empire, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, things are getting as bad as it can get, a king shall arise having fierce features, strong, intimidating features, who understands sinister schemes. It means that he has insights into puzzles, riddles, mysteries, tricks. This guy is a slick talker, this Antiochus. He knows how to manipulate people. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. Perhaps there was some supernatural demonic aid that helped make him so effective. We don't know that. But he shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. That word prosper is that this guy was ambitious. He was the king of Seleucids. He had India and Asia, but man, he wanted more. He wanted Israel. He wanted Egypt. And he would thrive. That word thrive means that he knows how to make deals. He's a wheeler dealer. And so he shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. And he, in fact, did great damage to the children of Israel. And then in verse 25, through his cunning, which refers to, that's a word that means clever, intelligent wisdom. This guy was smart, and he certainly was, Antiochus. But he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule. Deceit, the word means fraud. He will run cons and let other people do it. That word prosperity is a word that prosper under his rule is that he will use security and safety. I mean, this is an easy way to manipulate people, to tell them you are going to be safer. Obviously, I don't have to talk about it in our world today. We understand that people will give up almost anything. If somebody makes them think that, oh, this is going to stop bad things from happening to you, this is going to make you safe. And as I've quoted before, Benjamin Franklin, who said, people who will sacrifice freedom for security deserve neither. When we give up our freedoms in order to be safer, well, that's exactly what these people did, especially the Hellenistic Jews, who were like, look, yeah, the guy's kind of taken over our religion and he thinks he's Messiah, but we can appease him by going along with him. And that's exactly what verse 25 is saying. And he shall exalt himself in his heart, out of control ego, and he shall destroy many in their prosperity. They will do well, and that's what will destroy them is their own wealth, their own success. And then he shall even rise against the prince of princes. This isn't necessarily a reference to Messiah or even to God. The phrase prince of princes or Tsar of Tsars, Tsar just means a person who's a leader. So military commanders would be called a Tsar. Even a civic leader, a religious leader would be called a Tsar. So all he's saying is he will rise against the leaders of leaders. But he shall be broken without human means. Whatever kills him, it won't be the enemy that does it. Either if 2 Maccabees is right and God just struck him, hit him in the gut, and knocked him out, or whether it was he took his own life, again, broken. And it isn't people who are going to do it. And finally, in verse 26, the vision of the evenings and mornings, which was told, is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. And then it says, I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterward, I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one really understood it. This tells us a lot about Daniel, that something's being prophesied that he isn't going to witness, but human suffering and even leaders collapsing, that hurt him. It made him sick. You know, when we look at the future, when we try to predict, wow, what's our world gonna be like? Do we do it with a gloating sort of, well, that's what the Bible said would happen, woohoo, fulfill prophecy? Or do we look at people who bring pain on themselves and others and go, that breaks my heart. That's something that really hurts me. Daniel looked at it that way, but at the same time, he's like, okay, enough time to feel that. I need to get back to my job. And that's a good indication for us too. When we may feel devastated at some point, you got to slap yourself, you know, wash your face and get back to work. And that's the kind of guy that he was. So quite a quite a great story here that we read in Daniel chapter 8. We're going to see more as we finish through this book as well. But what are the takeaways? What is it that we look at this prophecy and the fact that it was fulfilled, especially in the development of the lives of Alexander the Great, one of the greatest leaders in human history, Antiochus Epiphanes, a mighty guy with power and influence over people who was at the cusp of the turn of what was going to happen in the world. What do we learn from it? I mean, first of all, literally, this is amazing predictions of history. The book of Daniel, as Daniel writes this prophecy, you look at what happened with the Medes and Persians, first of all, but then Alexander the Great, his four generals, Antiochus Epiphanes, that came out of the Seleucid kingdom. It's like, wow, Daniel was writing hundreds of years. He was writing around 600 BC. Now, there are people who, for years, critics, Bible critics, who said, the book of Daniel can't possibly have been written by Daniel. It can't be prophetic because it's so, he even mentions the Greek Empire that hadn't really been anything at that point. And so they said this book had to have been written ultimately after the time of the Jews retaking the temple and all of that. So basically they try to date it at, you know, 100 or 200 AD in order to feel comfortable that it didn't prophesy anything. Problem is, in other places, but especially in the Dead Sea Scrolls, where uncovered were not only complete documents of the book of Daniel, but lots of fragments of the book of Daniel being attributed to Daniel. And in the Dead Sea Scrolls, in writings that were written a couple hundred years before Christ, it was referring to Daniel's prophecies and quoting them as scripture. So the people who put the Dead Sea Scrolls together and hid them, these were ancient documents, speaking of ancient wisdom. And so once we got a look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, people realized this couldn't have been written, you know, after the fact. In the same way, like the prophecies in Isaiah of Jesus suffering and you know, his efficacious death, people said, well, Isaiah 53 couldn't have been written at the time of Isaiah. It would have had to have been written after Jesus. But again, Dead Sea Scrolls, complete manuscripts of Isaiah, a couple hundred years before Christ. Prophecy is amazing this way. And I think a lot of people, when they think of prophecy, they get all excited about the prophecies that are made that are yet to be fulfilled, such as we saw in Daniel 2 and 7 of Messiah coming, setting up his kingdom. But even more validating for those are the prophecies that have already been fulfilled so meticulously. And so we should look at chapter 8 and go, this helps me to understand this is real. And if this is true, if this came to pass, then Daniel's prophecies from earlier in chapter 7 of Messiah coming and reigning with his saints and everything, why? And that one's incorporated with these other guys too as a part of the prophecy. We can believe that God is going to do exactly what he says he's going to do. And Jesus will come again, because the same Daniel that called the developments of the Grecian Empire from Alexander the Great to his four generals to Antiochus the Fourth, the same Daniel has another chapter that talks about things that haven't yet been fulfilled. If you look at this and say, obviously this was past, but you look at the other prophecies concerning the coming of Messiah and you have to go, well, those haven't come to pass. It's a mistake to look at the prophecies of Messiah and say, well, it was just sort of supernaturally, you know, when Jesus died and rose from the dead, that was kind of like his setting up his kingdom, and today we are in the kingdom. Well, I would submit to you Daniel chapter 8, When he said it was going to be a kingdom, it was a real kingdom with real rulers. He even referred to the directions that their military campaigns would go, the directions in which they wouldn't go. Very literal. And so this chapter is really important to me in understanding how to interpret prophecy. But again, as the lesson that we learn constantly in the book of Daniel, and as we learn, frankly, in all of the scriptures, and if you study life and leadership, you understand this, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great human leaders who have the capacity to motivate and inspire people, quite often, almost always, will collapse upon themselves because, like with Alexander, like with Antiochus, we aren't designed to handle this kind of import. We aren't designed to be in spotlights. And when we are, the beginning of the end, the corruption that ultimately corrupts absolutely, we need to be so conscious of the danger of power. But we also see in this passage what corrupted power looks like. We saw with both of these guys, rage. Someone who gets angry is already showing the effects of what it looks like when your power has gone to your head, when you think that you have the right to do something and someone tries to stand in the way of it or it doesn't work out, you get angry. Anger and corruption are partners. Be careful whenever you're angry. You're beginning to show, you get, you know, rage starts coming. That's like the first warning signal that you are obsessed with your own power. But there's also a greed that you never have enough. You have plenty, but you're like, I just want more. And the kind of ambition that causes people to continue to get more is part of the corruption of power. You'll never have enough. Ultimately then, as with both of these guys, you start thinking that you're equal to God. You can, it's like, we see this in the religious world where people make up kind of their own twist on religion. And then as far as they're concerned, you don't even know God if you don't believe the same way that I do about everything. It's how every cult happens. Someone gets power and they begin to think that they are hearing from God. I'm doing this because God told me. Be very careful. Anytime you start thinking that there is authority behind anyone saying, this is what I think God is saying. I'll be the first to admit as a pastor, I'm trying to reflect what God is saying by sharing his word, but my interpretation of his word is not God's word. You're always welcome to disagree with my understanding of the word of God. I don't trust anyone who says, God told me, because most people that I know who tell me God told me this, it ends up being stupid. Plus, I grew up with a mentally ill person who God was talking to him all the time, but it's dangerous to think that you are uniquely hearing from God, but it's a part of what corrupted power looks like. You also see the clever schemes, the scams, the deceit, the fraud. You know, the emails that say, I was praying for you this morning, that kind of stuff. It's clever and complicated. It's the people who are putting out information on the internet, but saying, you know, we need you to text this number, or you should sign up for this. And then they get your information and your email address, and now they're going to make merchandise of the people through their scams. It's what they do. It's what corrupt power ultimately does. You just market people. You just see them as tithing units. You see them as hits. You see them as internet contacts. It's clever. It really is. But it's corrupting. And like in the case with both of these guys, a corrupt leader uses prosperity. Look how big we are. Look how wonderful we are. Hey, you are going to be wealthy if you do what we tell you to do. Ultimately, it will destroy. That's what it does. A corrupt, powerful person always appeals to security. Don't you want to be safe? If you just do what I tell you to do, everyone will be safe. No one will get hurt. We see this in our day and age. Every, little podunk political person, it doesn't matter if they're the dog catcher, they're making proclamations and telling you that you will be safer if you do. Look, people die all the time. We can't think that it's within our control to make everyone do well. Life isn't that way. But an easy way to manipulate people is to appeal to their desire for security. And if you can convince them that, you give up your freedom, but a lot of people will be safe as a result. That's the easiest way to manipulate people, and it always happens when power corrupts. Ultimately, corrupted power looks like self-destruction. In the cases of Alexander and Antiochus both, they knew how to destroy a lot of other people, but ultimately they will always destroy themselves. That's why people who are so successful, who pull off their scams, who build great fortunes, who become famous, so often they die at their own hand. It's self-destructive, or they indulge in behavior that completely torpedoes everything that they care about. Because ultimately, when you let ambition go crazy in your life, you're giving in to the one who did that first, the devil who ripped himself off completely. He had so much potential, and he traded it away, and now he just wants everyone else to do the same thing, and it will. Ultimately, success that goes to your head, ultimately, you don't need somebody else to destroy you. You'll destroy yourself. We've seen it over and over again. And the sad thing that I see in these two men, in these two kingdoms, is squandered talent. God gives people so much potential for greatness. Can you, look at people who are spending fortunes just to go to a great school. Here you are. You are sharp. You are a young teenager, and you're being trained by Aristotle, the greatest ever. And it turns out you're 16 years old, and you have a knack for leading soldiers. What an amazing opportunity this is. You're Antiochus. Nobody really worries about the Seleucids, but you find out I can take Egypt and I can take Israel. It's never enough. You throw away your talent. You throw away your opportunities. Life is so often a series of wasted potentials. Maybe you weren't educated by Aristotle. Maybe you aren't a genius or brilliant. But you know what? God has given every one of us gifts. And those gifts come with potential. One of the things the devil wants to do is to make you try to do something that isn't your gift. Like make Michael Jordan want to play baseball, or make actors or preachers want to be singers, or make singers want to be politicians. Or it seems like people, when they begin to become corrupted, it's not enough for me just to be the best at what I do, the best that I can. We always seem to want more, and therefore, so often, we throw away gifts from God. And we don't use those because we want to be somebody else. We can't ever get enough. That's something that we should be very, very cautious of, because it's the devil's favorite trick at destroying people in their potential. God sees us, and he knows our potential, and he believes in our potential, and he designs a life for us that's beautiful and perfect. The devil tries to convince us to go against the dream that God has for us. God has his picture of what our lives can be, and what the Bible calls sin. In the Greek, it's the word hamartia, means less than your ultimate destiny. We settle for something less because we want something else. Life starts today. What are we going to do with the lives that we have? How are we going to take advantage of all of the potential that we possess? Avoiding the selfish mind trips that will suck us in and ultimately destroy us. I would challenge everyone to just spend some time with God and ask Him, where does my potential lie? One of the great ways to find out where your potential is what have you done that worked the best? What is it that other people look at you and say, you know, you're great at that? Sure, there are people who will lie to you. All you have to do is look at the early rounds of the singing competitions on TV and think of those people's friends who told them they sing beautifully just because they want to see them on TV making fools of themselves. You got those, but I'm telling you, there is something. You have more potential than you realize, and what's stealing your potential and mine is when we get distracted at trying to do things that aren't our calling, that aren't within our giftedness. We want more, and we miss the opportunity to be the best that we can be. And I pray for each of you that you'd this week have a time to just think and consider, what does a focused life look like for me? How can I maximize the potential that I have? If you've never accepted Jesus, by the way, you're missing out on so much. God sent His Son to die for you so that you can be forgiven. If you reject that, then you're choosing to live your life ambitious for things that will melt away and disappear, never knowing the joy of being a child of God, never understanding the potential that comes when all of your mess ups are forgiven. You can connect with Him today. And I pray that if that's you, that you would within your own heart just say, okay, God, I really do want to maximize my potential. And I want to start by admitting that I'm not God and You are. And if Your Son died for me, I want to receive that gift and have a new start where I can live a life that's focused on my potential rather than this randomly scattered at ambitions that will ultimately end up letting me destroy myself. Pray that prayer. God will begin to work in your life in an amazing way for all of us. Let's focus on our potential. Let's think about what God has given us that we can do. Stop worrying about what you can't do. Oh, I can't go to a concert. I can't go to a movie. Man, there's so much we can do. Let's seize all of the potential that we have. And by the way, we have so much to be thankful for. On your worst pandemic day, do you understand how lucky we are? How blessed we are? The opportunities that are around us all the time? Let's focus on that. The other choice is to become a really cheesy version of Alexander or Antiochus and gradually self-destruct, explode our potential by not recognizing who we are and the potential for good that we can bring about. Let's pray. Lord, thank You for this amazing prophecy in this Daniel chapter 8. It's stunning. Knowing what we know objectively from history, there is no way we can explain how this guy, Daniel, knew this stuff before it happened. But it lets us recognize You are great. You know all. And because we know that You see kingdoms rise and fall and how that happens hundreds of years before it happens, You know what's coming for us as well. God, help us to humble ourselves, but at the same time, to ambitiously strive to become the best that we possibly can with the abilities that You give us. people who are listening, Lord, who are receiving you right now, who are finally coming to the point where they say, okay, I'll reshuffle the deck, I'll start over, I will allow God to forgive me. Help them to know they just made the best decision of their lives. Lead and guide them and all of us now and throughout the rest of our lives, the days we have. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.